This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
A long time ago, beyond a galaxy far, far away.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Thrawn Ascendancy, Book 3, Lesser Evil, by Timothy Zoth. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
For thousands of years, it has been an island of calm within the chaos. It is a center of power, a model of stability, and a beacon of integrity. The 9 ruling families guard it from within. The expansionary defense fleet guards it from without. Its neighbors are left in peace. Its enemies are left in ruin. It is light and culture. And glory, it is the Chiss Ascendancy.
Prologue.
Prepare for breakout.
Senior Captain Mithron Yorodo's voice echoed across the Springhawks Bridge.
All officers and warriors stand prepared. We're not here to start trouble. But I intend to be ready for it.
First Officer Mid-Captain Ufsa Makro scowled to himself. Of course, Senior Captain Thrawn didn't plan to start trouble. He never did. Yet somehow, trouble always seemed to happen. If that pattern was determined to continue, it couldn't have picked a better spot for it. Bad enough that Zyzek was an alien system. Worse, that Chiss records had nothing about it beyond its location, and that it was a trading center for several of the small nations to the east and southeast of the Chiss Ascendancy. Even worse, that Thrawn believed this to be the system where Captain Fazeer and his fellow Wateeth had been recruited to launch their ambush attack on his ship. Worst of all, that no one else knew the Springhawk was here. They should have gone straight back to the Ascendancy. They should have left the planet Hoxim and the skirmish Simakro had privately dubbed the Battle of the Three Families and headed back to Chila for repairs, debriefing, and what was likely to be a memorable job of sweeping the whole mess out the door. All the other Chiss warships, the ones crewed exclusively by members of the Zodlak, Aragol, and Palmrio families, had done exactly that. Making the slow jump-by-jump back home, while the commanders no doubt struggled to write all this up in their logs. But not the Springhawk. The hours Thrawn had spent studying the Wateeth freighter before its destruction had somehow convinced him that Zyzek was where Fazeer had come from. From there, it was only a small leap of tactical logic to swinging by that system on their way home and taking a look. Simakro understood the strategy. On one level, he even agreed with it. The Springhawk had Skywalker Chiri to speed it on its way through the twisting hyperspace pathways of the Chaos, while any observer who'd been lurking around to report on the battle would have some lesser navigator, or none at all. The fact that Thrawn could get to Zyzek ahead of that news could be a major advantage in information gathering. But that was one small plus, and it was piled on top of a whole stack of minuses.
Breakout. 3, 2, 1.
The star flares collapsed into stars, and the Springhawk had arrived.
Full scan, Thrawn ordered. Pay special attention to the ships in the various orbits. I want as complete a catalog of ship types as possible. Along with where in the orbital stack they are.
Yes, Senior Captain.
Mid-Commander Elo Dalvumek acknowledged from the sensor station.
Carol?
Assist her with the cataloging,
Thrawn added.
Yes, sir.
The voice of Senior Commander Placaril Morph came over the speaker from Secondary Command.
Dalvu, mark which sectors you want us to handle from here.
Yes, Senior Commander,
Dalvu said.
Marking them now.
Watch for movement, either inward as an attempt to hide from us, or outward in an attempt to flee,
Thrawn said.
We're here to see if we can create a reaction.
He nodded toward the helm.
Asmodee, start moving us inward. Skywalker Ciri, stand ready in case we need to leave quickly.
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Commander Tumaz Mor Diemir said from the helm.
Yes, Senior Captain.
Skywalker Ciri's caregiver Mithaili Estov echoed. Simakro let his eyes sweep slowly across the bridge. Dalvu, Carol, Asmodee. Officers he'd served with a long time, dating back to when he'd commanded the Springhawk, and continuing through Thrawn's current tenure as captain. He knew them and their abilities, and trusted them with his life. Thalias, on the other hand, he focused on the caregiver as she turned back to the viewport, her hand resting reassuringly on Ciri's shoulder. Thalias was still far too much of a mystery to him, with uncertainties and doubts swirling around her. Worse, from Simakro's point of view, she carried the stench of family politics. Syndic Mithurphy and Eco had done some fancy maneuvering in order to get her aboard the Springhawk, and Simakro still didn't know what Thurfian's game was. But he would find out. He'd already planted the seeds, feeding Thalias a story and conspiracy theory that painted Thrawn in a bad light. A story he knew she would eventually spill to Thurfian, or possibly to someone else. When she did, when she betrayed that confidence, he would finally have proof that she was a spy sent to destroy, or at least damage, the Springhawk's commander. Then, maybe, he'd be able to convince Thrawn to get her off his ship. Until then, all Simakro could do was watch her and guard as best he could against any mischief she might make.
We're here to create a reaction.
Unfortunately, Simakro had seen the kind of reaction Thrawn's unexpected appearances tended to spark, especially in potentially hostile territory and moving among large numbers of probably unfriendly ships. But Thrawn was the Springhawk's commander, and he'd given an order. Simakro's job was to do everything in his power to carry it out. And if part of his duty was to defend his ship to the death, well, he was prepared to do that too.
Conquest.
General Irias Nakir gazed out the viewport of the Kilji warcruiser Whetstone at the dozens of trading ships orbiting the planet Zyzek.
Conquest. An interesting concept, is it not?
The being known as Jixtus suggested. Nakir eyed his guest. It was unsettling having to deal with a being whose garments of robe, hood, gloves, and veil wrapped him in total concealment, especially given that such complete anonymity gave him a serious negotiating advantage over Nakir and his Kilji vassals. Once Jixtus learned how to read the emotional responses reflected in the patterns of ripples and stretches that moved through the dark orange Kilji skin, he would gain insight that went far deeper than Nakir's words. But Nakir had agreed to travel here with the alien, and the Kilji overlords had affirmed his decision. And so here they were. And, truth be told, Jixtus did have some intriguing ideas on how the future of the Kilji Illumin could be shaped.
People who would otherwise ignore the wisdom and guidance of the Kiljis would be encouraged to listen,
Jixtus continued.
People who would otherwise scorn and scoff at your philosophy could be silenced or sent where their rantings would not disturb or disrupt.
It would allow us to bring order,
Nakir agreed. Images of unprecedented stability running through his mind.
Conquest.
Exactly,
Jixtus said.
Order and enlightenment to billions who currently struggle and flail helplessly in darkness. As you well know, encouragement and persuasion, even passionate persuasion, can move a culture only so far. Conquest is the only way to bring Kilji insight to the whole of a region.
And you believe these beings are prepared to receive such insight?
Nakir asked, sweeping his hand across the viewport at the merchant ships floating placidly in their orbits.
Is there ever a time when enlightenment would not be beneficial?
Jixtus countered.
Whether they realize it or not, whether they accept it or not, the Kilji path is what will ultimately bring them prosperity and contentment. What purpose delay?
What purpose indeed?
Nakir agreed, gazing at the ships. So many merchants, so many nations, all standing helpless before the might of the Kilji Illumin. Which should he choose first?
As I promised, we will guide you as to the nations most quickly and easily conquered,
Jixtus continued.
There are representative traders here from each of the four the Grisks feel are the most promising. We'll speak with them in turn, perhaps sample the goods they've brought for sale. You will then...
General Arias,
Vassal 2 called from the sensor station.
A new ship has arrived. Unknown configuration.
Nakir looked at the visual display. The newcomer was indeed unlike any of the other ships already in orbit. Representatives of some new nation, no doubt, here to join in barter and trade. Or perhaps not. The design of the craft was not that of a merchant. Its shape, the systematic groupings of bulges along its sides and shoulders, the distinctive sheen of a Nyx's alloy hull.
These are not traders,
he said.
That is a warship, is it not?
He added, turning to look at Jixtus, only to find the Grisk silent and unmoving. The veiled face was turned toward the visual display, the robed figure as still as if the being hidden beneath the robe had turned to stone. Usually, Jixtus had a comment for everything. For once, he didn't.
If you're concerned, you need not be,
Nakir reassured him. The newcomer was about two-thirds the size of the whetstone, probably no more than the equivalent of a Kilji picket cruiser with a comparable ratio of weaponry. Should they choose to initiate combat, he had no doubt the Kiljis would win. He could only hope they wouldn't be so foolish. The destruction of their ship would mean those aboard would never hear the Kilji philosophy, and thus could never achieve true enlightenment.
General Arias, the warship is broadcasting a message,
Vassal 4 said. He touched a switch.
To all assembled merchants and traders,
A smooth, melodious voice came over the Whetstone's bridge speaker. The Minasiat trade language words articulated with clipped precision.
I'm Senior Captain Thrawn of the Chiss Expansionary Defense Fleet warship Springhawk. I have news for any Wateeth who may be present. Are there any of that species to whom I may speak?
Are there?
Nakir asked, looking back at Jixtus. Jixtus stirred, breaking whatever paralysis had overtaken him.
Are there what?
He asked, his voice odd.
Are there any Wateeth?
Jixtus seemed to gather himself together.
I don't know. I didn't notice any of their ships when we arrived, but I also wasn't looking for them. I suggest we hold here and see if anyone answers him.
If no one else stands forth, I will speak with him,
Nakir declared.
I would learn what news he bears.
I would advise against that,
Jixtus warned.
The Chiss are a devious species. He is likely asking that question in the hope of drawing you out into the open.
Drawing me out?
Nakir asked.
Who would even know I'm here?
I didn't mean you specifically, General Irias,
Jixtus said.
But be assured, he's hunting for information. That's what this particular Chiss does.
If no one wishes news,
Thrawn continued,
perhaps someone will give us the location of their world, so that we may return our prisoners to their people.
Nakir looked at Jixtus with surprise.
He has prisoners?
No,
Jixtus bit out.
He doesn't.
He says he does.
He lies,
Jixtus said.
As I told you already, he's hunting for information. This is a trick.
How do you know?
Nakir persisted. Again, Jixtus fell silent.
Tell me how you know, Jixtus of the Krisks,
Nakir repeated, making it an order this time.
If the Chiss mounted a raid, there would of course be prisoners. If there was a battle, even the most fearsome often leave survivors. Tell me now, I shall ask him.
There was a battle,
Jixtus said reluctantly.
But there were no survivors.
How can you be certain?
Because I was the one who sent the Wateeth against the Chiss,
Jixtus said.
23 Wateeth went into that battle. 23 Wateeth died.
I ask again, how do you know that?
There was an observer at the battle,
Jixtus said. He sounded more on balance now.
One who was concealed from the combatant's view. He brought me that news.
I see,
Nakir said, pretending he was satisfied. Only he wasn't. Because an observer who had spoken of Wateeth deaths would also have warned that the Springhawk had survived that battle. Yet Jixtus had clearly been surprised by the Chiss warship's arrival. Was it merely the Springhawk's appearance here at Zyzak, and not the simple fact of its survival, that had startled him? And how did he know that this Chiss was seeking information? Did Jixtus know him personally? For a moment, Nakir considered asking those questions. But there would be no gain. Jixtus was withholding information, and would undoubtedly continue to do so.
That was the way of those who lacked enlightenment. No matter. There was, after all, another source of information close at hand.
Vessel One! Your rotation to face the Chiss ship,
he ordered. He waited until the whetstone was lined up precisely on the incoming warship, then keyed his mic.
Senior Captain Thrawn, this is General Rhys Nakir of the Kil-Geolumin warship Whetstone,
he called.
Tell me how you come to have Watith prisoners.
I greet you, General Rhys Nakir,
Thrawn said.
Are you an ally or trading associate of the Watith?
Certainly, I am not yet either,
Nakir said.
But perhaps soon.
Thrawn said.
You have come here to initiate new trade relationships, then?
Nakir's skin stretched in a wry smile. Jixtus had been right. This Chiss was on the hunt for information.
Not specifically,
he said.
We of the Illumin travel the chaos, teaching others the guilty way of order and enlightenment.
A noble undertaking,
Thrawn said.
Have the Watith been among your students?
Again, not yet,
Nakir said.
We are newly arrived in this part of space, but such things are for the future. Tell me, how you come to have Watith prisoners?
For the moment, those details must remain confidential.
No matter,
Nakir said.
I will accept your prisoners and return them to their home.
Do you know where that home is?
Nakir hesitated. If he said yes, Thrawn would likely ask for the coordinates and take the prisoners there himself. If he said no, Thrawn would probably refuse to hand them over.
I have already made many contacts among the traders here,
he said, choosing a third option.
One of them can surely provide that information.
I appreciate your offer,
Thrawn said.
But I cannot in good conscience accept it. If there are no Watith here to receive the prisoners, we will take our search elsewhere.
I would not have you go to such trouble.
That is my choice to make, not yours.
Enlightenment requires that I serve others.
You serve here best by permitting me to go my way,
Thrawn said.
Or does your enlightenment require you to take away my freedom of choice?
Let him go, Jixtus murmured. Just let him go.
Nakir felt a ripple of anger. Anger at Jixtus, anger at Thrawn. There were important details here that neither of them was willing to give him. He needed Jixtus and the Grisks to show him which nations were most open to conquest and thus enlightenment. He didn't need Thrawn.
You should learn of what you speak before offering judgment,
he said, keying his board to begin the Whetstone's ramp up to combat status.
Someday soon, I shall bring the Kilji philosophy to the Chiss.
I fear you will find little interest,
Thrawn said.
We have our own ancient paths.
The Kilji path will prove superior.
No,
Thrawn said, his voice flat.
It will not.
Again! You dismiss our wisdom without even hearing it!
In my experience, superior wisdom can stand on its own merits,
Thrawn said.
It does not require a warship to force acceptance.
You also bring a warship to this place.
But I do not claim to offer others superior wisdom,
Thrawn said.
Nor do I intend to impose my wisdom upon others.
He's trying to goad you into attacking him,
Sixtus warned quietly, his voice sounding strained.
Don't let him.
Nakir felt a stretch of contempt. Why shouldn't he let the Chiss build his own destruction? The Whetstone was far mightier than Thrawn's Springhawk. It would be the work of a few minutes to destroy him.
He's trying to obtain data on the Whetstone's capabilities,
Chixtus went on.
And on your abilities as its commander.
And why shouldn't he demonstrate the might of a Kil-Gee war cruiser? Whatever knowledge Thrawn might gain would be lost in the abyss of his death. Still, there were others here who would witness that battle. Perhaps it would be unwise to show them the full might of the Kil-Gees before the Kil Horde visited their worlds to show them the path of enlightenment. But to even look as if he was allowing the Chiss to dictate his course of action.
Warships, this is Zyzek's system defense!
A new voice came over the bridge speaker.
You are both requested to stand down!
Nakir felt a ripple of cold amusement. The four patrol craft that had risen from the mass of merchant ships and split into pairs to confront the Whetstone and Springhawk were smaller and even more pathetic than the Chiss warship. Should they demand battle, it would take only a single laser volley to send them beyond all chance of enlightenment.
The Kil-Gees cannot enlighten them if they are dead,
Chixtus reminded him. He was right, of course. More important, perhaps, it gave him a legitimate excuse to refuse combat with the Chiss.
Zyzek system defense! I comply with your request,
he said.
Senior Captain Thrawn, you may keep your prisoners. I will see you again when I arrive among your people to change the ancient paths of the Chiss to the fuller enlightenment of the Kil-Gees.
I will look forward to our next encounter,
Thrawn said.
Farewell.
Until the meeting,
Nakir said. He keyed off and turned yet again to Chixtus.
You spoke of four nations that the Kil-Gees should first seek to enlighten,
he said.
I choose instead the Chiss.
Not yet, Chixtus said. You must start with other beings.
Why?
Chixtus shook his head, the motion rippling the hood and veil.
Because I know these Chiss, General Arius. They are resilient and powerful. I've seen them resist attack from without and manipulation from within. Only a combination of the two will succeed in bringing about their destruction.
Enlightenment is incompatible with delay,
Nakir warned.
And you spoke of conquest, not destruction. If all are destroyed, Who then shall we guide to peace and order?
A remnant shall certainly survive, Jixtus promised. The common folk, those who will accept Kilji rule without question or resistance, will be yours to enlighten. But to achieve that, the leaders and commanders must fall.
I agree,
Nakir said.
So, let us proceed to their world and begin that process.
They must fall on the schedule the Grisks have constructed,
Jixtus said.
If we deviate from that timeline, all will be lost. But,
he lifted a finger,
that doesn't mean you have to wait to meet them. In fact, I've always intended that you and the Whetstone would carry me on my first visit to their worlds and their leaders.
Very well,
Nakir said, gazing at the display. The Springhawk had turned away from the planet now and was heading back out of the gravity well toward deep space.
I will follow your guidelines for now. But be warned, if I feel you're proceeding too slowly, I'll take that timeline into my own hands.
Understood,
Jixtus said.
Hold fast to my guidance, and the Chiss will be yours in good time.
In swift time,
Nakir corrected.
And when you destroy their leaders, you will leave me this one. This throne.
His skin stretched in a grim smile.
I am anxious for him to face true enlightenment.
The Springhawk was back in hyperspace, and the tension of that brief encounter was finally starting to leave Thalias's shoulders when Simacro finished his search of the ship's archives.
There's nothing here about a species or government called the Kilgees, Senior Captain,
he reported.
Also no references to a General Arius Nakir. Understandable,
Thrawn said.
But we have heard that title before.
Thalias stole a look over her shoulder. Simacro's face, she noted, had that telltale hint of someone chewing on something sour.
Yes, sir, he confirmed. The battle dreadnought that attacked the Vigilant and Greyshrike at sunrise mentioned it.
Suggesting they and General Arius Nakir may be in some way connected,
Thrawn said.
Yes, sir,
Simacro said again, a hint of reluctance joining the hint of sourness. Small wonder. The first officer had argued with Thrawn, respectfully and quietly, of course, but still argued, about Thrawn's plan to swing by Zyzek before returning to the Ascendancy. Simacro had suggested it would be both dangerous and pointless, while Thrawn had been convinced the side trip would be worthwhile. Once again, Thrawn had been proven right. Though whether anything he'd learned would ultimately prove useful, Thalias couldn't guess.
We also know that the General Arius wasn't alone just now,
Simacro continued.
There were four instances when we could hear a second voice behind the first. Very faint, but definitely not the same person. Probably not even the same species.
I agree, Thrawn said.
Have the analysts been able to draw anything from those interruptions?
Not yet, Simacro said. The voice was quiet, and Nakir's transmission wasn't as clear as we might have hoped. We've been able to identify a few of the words, but a full analysis may have to wait until we can hand it over to the experts on Naparar.
Have the Endless continue their work, Thrawn said. Not just the words, but also as much of the vocal profile as they can obtain.
Yes, sir, Simacro said. Thalias glanced back again. Simacro had moved off and was logging the order into his Questus. Thrawn, for his part, was gazing thoughtfully across the bridge, his eyes slightly unfocused, a sign Thalias had learned to recognize as deep thought. She turned back forward, looking down at Ciri. The girl's eyes were likewise unfocused, though in her case, it was because she was totally immersed in third sight as she guided the Springhawk toward home.
Caregiver?
Thalias twitched and spun around to find Thrawn standing right behind her.
You shouldn't sneak up on people that way, Senior Captain,
she said reproachfully.
My apologies,
Thrawn said, sounding more amused than actually sorry.
You need to learn how to think and ponder without sacrificing the awareness of your surroundings.
He nodded toward Ciri.
How is she?
She's fine,
Thalias said, looking down at the girl.
She'll need a rest break in about 40 minutes, but she got plenty of sleep last night and seems to be doing fine.
That's not what I meant,
Thrawn said, lowering his voice.
I'm talking about her and the mages.
Thalias felt her throat tighten. She'd hoped she'd been the only one who'd seen that.
It may have just been a coincidence.
Do you believe that?
Thalias sighed. The mages, the leader of a group of alien refugees, had been woken from her forced hibernation in order to look at a sample of jewelry that was being used by a group called the Agbui against a Zodlak family counselor on Selwys. Once the mages had identified the brooch, Thrawn had asked for her to go back into hibernation until she could be returned to her people, currently waiting for her on the Pakian homeworld of Rapak. Not surprisingly, knowing now that her world was under outside threat, the mages had resisted the idea of going back to sleep. Thrawn's warning that she needed to be kept hidden lest she be spotted by an officer who came to the Skywalker suite on other business had made no impact on her whatsoever. She'd been so adamant, in fact, that Thalias had thought for a minute that Thrawn and Simacro would have to physically force her back into the hibernation chamber. And then, all at once, she'd abandoned the fight and meekly accepted Thrawn's order. But before she settled back into the chamber, her eyes had flicked in the direction of Ciri's sleeping room. Back on Rapak, at the first meeting between Thrawn and the refugees, the mages had somehow recognized that Thalias had once been a Skywalker, able to use third sight to navigate through hyperspace. Had she also sensed Ciri's presence and her much more powerful connection with whatever it was that Third Sight allowed her to access?
No, I don't really believe it,
she conceded.
But I still hope it was. I mean, there were two bulkheads and the whole day room between her and Ciri. How could she have known through all of that?
The mages claimed her people join with the beyond after death,
Thrawn reminded her.
The fact that she recognized you'd once been a Skywalker suggests there's something of that connection present during life as well.
But on Rapak, she was at least looking at me, Thalias said. If she'd seen Ciri, I might understand it, but she never did.
Thrawn shifted his gaze to the viewport and the hyperspace swirl outside.
If the beyond is the same force that General Skywalker told me about, it appears to have many aspects and manifestations. It's possible
This is a new facet that the Magus hadn't yet experienced.
I thought all her people were connected to the Beyond.
If all your species hummed a particular note, you'd become used to hearing it, Thrawn said. If you then met a species who didn't hum at all, but then also found an individual who hummed a different note, that would be something both new and notable.
Ah,
Thalias said, nodding.
Yes, I see. Anything new, either presence or absence, can be informative.
Yes, Thrawn said. As you undoubtedly noted with General Arias Nakir.
Thalias' lips puckered. She'd thought she was the only one who'd spotted that, too, and had planned to keep it to herself until she could mention it privately to Thrawn.
You mean the fact that he never asked how many Wateeth prisoners we had?
Very good, Thrawn said approvingly. Your analytical skill has grown considerably since you first came aboard the Springhawk.
Thank you,
Thalias said, feeling her cheeks warm with the compliment.
Though, if it has, it's due to your skill as a teacher.
I disagree, Thrawn said. I don't teach, but merely guide. Each person approaches problems differently. All I do is ask the questions that set that person on their best path to the solution.
I see,
Thalias murmured. But only if that person was willing to put forth the effort to learn that path to logic and reason, she suspected. Too many people, possibly even the majority of them, were all too content to let others do that thinking and analysis for them.
So, what do we conclude from Nakir's lack of curiosity?
Thrawn prompted.
That he already knew how many people Captain Fazeer had in his freighter.
Thalias frowned.
Or possibly that they were all already dead?
The latter is the explanation I'm leaning toward, Thrawn said. Which would in turn suggest that the other person speaking in the background was connected with whoever hired Fazeer.
Yes, that makes sense,
Thalias agreed, thinking it through.
A trading center like Zyzek draws a lot of different nations and species. If our mystery alien had success hiring Fazeer, he might well go back there for his next hire.
I agree, Thrawn said. Which brings up yet another question.
Thalias winced.
What exactly has he hired Nakir to do?
Yes, Thrawn said. I was hoping that these attacks on the Ascendancy had come to an end. I fear they haven't.
Doesn't look like it,
Thalias said, a hollow feeling in the pit of her stomach. Because even if and when the threats to the Ascendancy ended, the threats to Thrawn himself were likely to continue. Fleetingly, she thought back to her brief conversation with Patriarch Thuraki at the Myth family homestead. There, he'd encouraged her to help protect Thrawn from the political pressures that, despite his military genius, he seemed unable to recognize and counter. Thalias certainly had the will to do so. The crucial question was whether a lowly Skywalker caregiver had any of the necessary power.
But if the attacks continue,
she said, wondering if Thrawn even realized she was giving a twofold answer,
we'll just have to beat them again.
The summons to Spassia had been quick and abrupt, and had given Supreme General Bakheef barely enough time to close down his office in an orderly way and get across Chaplar to the landing field just outside the city. The scout ship he'd requisitioned was ready, one of the five that were always kept on 15-minute readiness for Senior Defense Hierarchy Council members. And 20 minutes later,
He was out of Chila's gravity well and into the mesmerizing swirl of hyperspace. It wasn't the way Barkeep liked doing business. Many of his colleagues, in fact, would never move this quickly for anything short of all-out war. But the summons had come directly from Stibla Patriarch Stibla Miovado's office, and the Patriarch had said it concerned Senior Captain Thrawn, and that was all Barkeep needed to know. Lamiov was waiting outside the massive door of Vault 4 when Barkeep finally finished with the rigorous Universal Analysis Group security protocols.
Supreme General,
the Patriarch called in greeting as Barkeep walked across the entry chamber, doing his best to ignore the silent guards standing their impassive watch over the Ascendancy's most secret base.
Thank you for coming.
It's always a pleasure to visit the UAG, Your Venerante, Barkeep said as he reached the other. Mind you, a bit more warning would have been appreciated.
Trust me, you had only about 10 minutes less than I got,
Lamiov said.
Senior Captain Thrawn was playing this one even closer than usual.
Does it have anything to do with why he's so late back from whatever the Zodlak, Aragol, and Pomrio are involved in?
Is he that late?
Lamiov asked, frowning.
I was under the impression that those family ships only arrived a day ago.
True enough, Barkeep said. But the Springhawk had a Skywalker, and the family ships didn't. By all rights, Thrawn should have been here at least a day or two ahead of them.
Interesting,
Lamiov murmured.
Maybe he stayed at Hoxim to take a closer look at the freighter crash site.
Barkeep gave a little snort.
You do realize you're rattling off details that only the Council is supposed to have, right?
Really, Supreme General,
Lamiov said dryly.
If you haven't figured out by now that the Stibla have our own special information sources, you really have no business in your current seat of power. Seriously, though, you're going to love this one. Shall we go take a look?
After you,
Barkeep said, falling into step beside Lamiov, peripherally noting that the nearest guard stirred slightly as the two men walked the rest of the way to the vault door. Early in the UAG's existence, Barkeep had been told there'd been some thought in the Sindicure of removing family ties from all of its personnel, as was routinely done with senior military officers, and for the same reason of hopefully eliminating family politics. Ultimately, it was decided that such an action would draw too much unwanted attention to the facility, and the idea was dropped. As a compromise, though, UAG uniforms didn't include any family identification, neither the family crests of the 9 and the 40, nor the stylized names used by the Ascendancy's other, lesser families. Here at UAG, in theory, all were equal. Still, Barkeep suspected that most, if not all, of the guards on Vault 4 were Stibla. Lamiov would have seen to that. Given that a new alien artifact had just arrived, Barkeep had fully expected the large receiving area at the front part of the vault to be crowded. He wasn't prepared, though, for just how crowded it actually was. Part of that was the sheer size of the artifact. A 4-meter-long lattice of white metal ribs that looked like a section of some giant sea monster's torso skeleton. A dozen techs were hovering around it, taking readings and measurements, or attaching leads to other analysis devices. Two senior UAG staff were also in the mix, one of them overseeing the work, the other working busily with his questus. Standing off to one side, silently watching all the activity, were Senior Captain Thrawn and Mid-Captain Samakro. Both men looked over as Barkeep and Lamiov walked up to them.
Patriarch Lamiov, Supreme General Barkeep, Thrawn said in greeting. You honor us with your presence.
You honor us with yet another intriguing device for our collection,
Lamiav said.
Go ahead and tell Supreme General Barkeev what you've brought.
Yes, Your Venerante.
Thrawn shifted his attention to Barkeev.
During our search for remnants of the Vagari pirates, we encountered an alien freighter that was supposedly being attacked by 3 gunships. We subsequently determined that the battle had been staged for our benefit, and that the scenario was merely the first step in a trap.
Obviously, the aliens didn't know much about you, Barkeev commented.
No. Their knowledge of the Chiss was quite limited,
Thrawn said, apparently missing the subtle compliment completely.
What intrigued me was the fact that the feigned attack was already in progress when we emerged from hyperspace. That suggested to me that the aliens had a way of predicting when and where a ship would arrive.
Barkeev looked over at the skeletal artifact, an odd tightness settling into the pit of his stomach.
And this is what allowed them to do that?
We believe so, yes,
Thrawn said.
The lattice was built into the space between the freighter's inner and outer hulls, and was attached to the equipment boxes via those cables.
Barkeev nodded as he belatedly spotted the rolling tables off to the side with oddly shaped boxes and neatly coiled wires resting on them.
Was the entire lattice like this?
He asked.
The parts we were able to investigate were,
Thrawn said.
Unfortunately, the time we had to devote to our analysis was severely limited.
Any idea how much warning the device gives before the incoming ship arrives?
Barkeev asked.
Based on the state of the false attack as it appeared to us, I estimate they had at least 90 seconds to prepare,
Thrawn said.
Possibly more.
90 seconds?
Barkeev murmured, his mind spinning with the possibilities. Put a couple of picket ships equipped with such early warning devices in orbit at the combat edge of each Chiss world, and sneak attacks would be all but impossible. Even better, if the lattice could detect the ships moving through hyperspace, even if those vessels weren't preparing to return to space normal, the defense force could monitor the most common lanes through the ascendancy. And if the device could not only detect passing vessels, but also give an estimate of how many were involved.
Easy, Supreme General,
Lamiav warned. Barkeev blinked away the string of thought.
The what? I know that look,
Lamiav said.
I'm bound to caution you that just because we have one of these devices doesn't mean we'll be able to reverse engineer it.
I know,
Barkeev said, his excitement fading somewhat. So far, both of Thrawn's major contributions to Vault 4, the Vagari gravity well generator, and the Republic advanced shield technology, had resisted the UAG's best efforts to tease out their secrets. Barkeev had no doubt that sooner or later the Ascendancy's techs would succeed, but it was clearly going to continue to be an uphill climb. Unfortunately, there was no reason to believe this advanced warning detector would deviate from that pattern.
I just wish I knew why every item the Defense Force could find an immediate use for takes forever to crack,
Barkeev added.
That does seem to be the way of the universe, doesn't it?
Lamiav conceded.
The high-density electronics memory unit that was brought to us 100 years ago was being utilized in Questis storage bars within 12 months. The specialized cooking system someone found 30 years ago was on the market in 5 months.
But something that could upgrade a warship's electrostatic barrier defenses by 1,000% or more?
Barkeev shook his head.
Perhaps we'll have better luck with this one,
Lamiav said, nodding to the lattice.
It's a shame you couldn't bring back the entire freighter.
He raised his eyebrows slightly in silent question.
Yes,
Thrawn said simply. Either he'd missed the invitation in the Patriarch's tone and expression, or he'd already decided not to provide any further details about what had happened to the freighter.
We removed what appeared to be all of the equipment, plus as much of the lattice as we could,
Simacro added, also ignoring the unstated request.
Hopefully it will be enough for you to work with.
We'll do our best,
Lamiav assured him.
Is there anything more the Tech should know?
I don't believe so,
Thrawn said.
Mid-Captain? Nothing major that I can think of,
Simacro said.
I'll note in passing that even though the freighter was part of an ambush, and therefore might be considered a type of warship, its hull was standard civilian design. No Nyaks. Not even a Nyaks alloy inner shell.
That could be significant,
Lamiav said.
It could,
Simacro said.
My inclination is to put it down to the designers preferring to maintain the freighter illusion, and that it has nothing to do with the detector itself.
Probably,
Bakif agreed, his thoughts heading off in a new direction. Still, Nyaks had some unique characteristics, which was one reason it worked so well for warship hulls. If one or more of those features interfered with this advanced warning detector, that might provide some clues as to how the device worked.
Regardless, I'll make the techs aware of that,
Lamiav said.
And now, I believe the Council is expecting you at Chila.
Yes, Thrawn said. But before we leave, Supreme General, I request your presence aboard the Springhawk. There's another situation we need to discuss.
Can it wait?
Bakif asked. Thrawn and Simacro exchanged looks.
Yes, sir. I suppose it can,
Thrawn said reluctantly.
For a time.
Then it waits,
Bakif said firmly.
I have only a few hours to discuss some pressing matters with Patriarch Lamiav before I also have to return. And as the Patriarch said, the Springhawk is already overdue back at Chila for examination and whatever refitting and rearming are necessary.
He raised his eyebrows towards Simacro.
At which point you, Mid-Captain, are on my list of officers to speak with about the Hoxim incident. You'll have until then to prepare your statement and organize any documents you might wish entered into the record.
Understood, Supreme General,
Simacro said.
Though, if I may, he glanced at Thrawn, I would urge you not to delay your trip to the Springhawk any longer than necessary.
I'll take your suggestion under advisement,
Bakif said, frowning. Simacro's expression was the standard neutral of an officer addressing a superior, but there was also an unusually strong layer of tension beneath it. Whatever Thrawn wanted to discuss with Bakif, Simacro wasn't looking forward to the conversation. Even with that added level of intrigue, though, it would have to wait. Right now, Hoxim and its fallout were Bakif's priority.
I'll see you back at Chila, then,
he said, gesturing the two officers back toward the vault door.
Get started on the refit, and I'll call when I'm ready for your interviews.
Chapter 1 The Vigilant was 3 minutes from its destination, and Admiral Arulani was starting to wonder if her ship would be ready when they arrived, when Senior Captain Kiwutra Omis finally returned to the bridge.
Sorry about the delay, Admiral,
Utra O said as she crossed to Arulani's command chair.
Breacher 1 really didn't want to be fixed, but we persuaded it.
Arulani looked over at the weapons status board. The number one Breacher missile launcher still showed red, flicked to green.
Excellent,
she told Wu Tro.
Be sure to log a commendation to the repair team. It's never a good idea to head into a situation with one hand stuck in your pocket. Yes, ma'am,
Wu Tro said.
Though, if I may, I'm still not entirely clear as to what you're expecting the situation to be. Because I'm not entirely clear about it myself,
Aralani confessed.
It's just something about that last Nicardoon base that still bothers me. Which part?
Wu Tro asked.
The lead time the attack is needed to set up that slow approach asteroid attack? Or the fact that the base was too big to have been a listening post or anything else on Yiv's lists? Both. Plus something else I can't put my finger on,
Aralani said.
I'm hoping I'll recognize it when I see it. Let's also hope the Council won't be annoyed with us for taking this little side trip,
Wu Tro warned.
We're already way beyond the time limit Bakeef gave us for checking out Sunrise. Even Thrawn's already made it back from his pirate search, and you know how long he takes when he's on the hunt. And we still don't know why our friends with the Battle Dreadnought are so interested in this place. It has to have something to do with the mining operation Senior Warrior Yopring spotted,
Aralani said.
The amount of activity down there already tells us something big is happening. As in the fighters who chased him away. And I'd say we've got it pinpointed. Unless we've got two different groups in play,
Wu Tro pointed out.
The miners and the Battle Dreadnought could be fighting each other. But I suppose that's unlikely. My main concern is that even if we agree that the mines are the focal point, we don't know what's down there. Mines usually mean metal ore of some sort. Right. But digging doesn't always mean mining,
Wu Tro said.
It could also be something the inhabitants deliberately buried that someone else wants to dig up.
Aralani frowned. That possibility hadn't occurred to her.
You mean like some weapon or artifact? That's what I was wondering,
Wu Tro said.
It's not like we haven't run into things like that before. Senior Captain Thrawn, for one, has almost made a second career of digging them up. Though not literally digging them up,
Aralani pointed out.
Usually they've been sitting out in the open, ready to be walked off with. Maybe we'll get to pick up this one,
Wu Tro said, with a wry smile.
Maybe you can work a deal with Thrawn. He gets the stuff that's above ground, you get the stuff you have to dig for.
I'll be sure to bring that up next time I see him,
Aralani promised, looking at the chrono.
Almost there.
Prepare for breakout,
she called, raising her voice so that the entire bridge could hear her.
And be ready.
She gestured an invitation to Wu Tro.
Senior Captain. Yes, ma'am.
Wu Tro paused, watching the timer.
Breakout,
she called.
3, 2, 1.
The Star Flares collapsed to stars, and as it had once before, the Vigilant found itself floating among the scattered debris of the demolished Nicardoon base.
Bicleon?
Wu Tro prompted.
Yes, ma'am,
Senior Commander Obiklionov called from the sensor station.
Combat range clear. Mid-range clear. Far range... Admiral, we have movement. 3 ships close into the central base structure.
And the identification?
Aralani asked, frowning at the tactical. 2 of the ships were relatively small, while the 3rd was much larger, with the typical shape of a freighter.
No beacons,
Junior Captain Evro Skim Ormi reported from the weapons station.
The large ship shows no weapons emplacements. Probably a freighter. Possibly a mobile repair dock.
I'd say the latter, Admiral,
Bicleon said.
There are some spots along the ventral plane that look like mounting nodes. The two smaller ships, definitely warships. Patrol ships, at least. Possibly destroyers.
Orlani scowled.
Under normal circumstances, a Night Dragon man of war like the Vigilant could defeat a pair of patrol ships practically in its sleep. Unfortunately, the situation here wasn't normal. The Vigilant and Senior Captain Lakinda's Greyshrike had taken on that unidentified battle dreadnought over Sunrise. And even with Lakinda handing over all her remaining breacher missiles and plasmasphere fluid before she headed back to the Ascendancy, Orlani was still severely underarmed. Up to now, the Vigilant had been lucky. Arlani's investigation of the devastated planet had reached her chosen endpoint without drawing enemy attention or interference. But that luck might be about to run out.
"Any idea if they've spotted us?" she asked.
"No indication of it," Bicleon said.
"They seem to be concentrating on whatever they're doing at the base." "Admiral, we have activity!"
Junior Commander Stibla Ursiomli spoke up urgently from the comm station.
"Tight beam laser transmission! We're just catching the edge of it!"
"Uh-oh," Wutro muttered.
Orlani nodded, wincing. For Larsiom to be picking up the edge of a laser transmission, the intended recipient must be almost directly behind them.
"Fold barriers!" she ordered. "Octremo, you're 90 degrees starboard!"
"Yes, ma'am,"
Mid-Commander Droke Tremors confirmed from the helm. The electrostatic barriers came up, and the collection of debris outside the viewport spun sideways as the Vigilant rotated.
"Incoming!"
Oskim snapped, his warning punctuated by a blaze of light as the Vigilant spectrum lasers flashed out at the pair of missiles streaking toward them.
"Patrol cruiser, mark it as Bogey 1, coming in fast from behind us."
"Defensive fire, lasers only,"
Arlani ordered, looking at the tactical. The Vigilant could run its lasers indefinitely, but had only 6 breacher missiles and enough fluid for 20 plasma spheres. That wasn't nearly enough to go toe-to-toe with a patrol cruiser and a pair of patrol ships. Which just meant she would have to get creative.
"Oskim, have the thrusters in breachers 1 and 2 disabled,"
she told the weapons officer.
"As quickly as possible. Let me know when they're ready."
"Yes, ma'am,"
Oskim said, frowning at his board, but knowing better than to question his commander in the middle of a battle.
"Techs are on it."
"Remind them that neatness doesn't count,"
Arlani said.
"Shrimo, some mild evasive maneuvers. Keep us clear of their missiles, but don't move us out of this general area. Bicleon?"
"Patrol ships have been alerted, Admiral," the sensor officer reported. "Designating as bogeys 2 and 3, still hugging the base, but they're turning weapons toward us."
"Let me know if they start moving."
On the tactical, Bogey 1 was accelerating toward them and had now launched another pair of missiles. At this range, the Vigilant's lasers had enough time to take them out. But if the attacker got close enough, that window would close, and Arlani would be forced to use her limited supply of breachers or plasmaspheres to protect her ship.
"Oskim?"
"Almost there,"
Oskim said.
"Tech report?" "Yes. Thrusters disabled, Admiral."
Finally.
"Drop them out of their tubes,"
she told him, giving the tactical another look.
"Octremo, as soon as they're clear of the hull, get us moving toward the base and bogeys 2 and 3. Again, minor evasive, but don't stray far from the direct vector. And stand by aft lasers,"
Wutro added, as the Vigilant turned away from the incoming patrol cruiser and started accelerating toward the wrecked base.
"Understood,"
Oskim said.
"Timing, Admiral?"
"Use your best judgment," Arlani told him. "Octremo, keep an eye on Bogey 1. Make sure we're leading it in the right direction."
"Yes, ma'am. Bogeys 2 and 3 are on the move,"
Bicleon warned.
leaving the repair dock now and heading toward us.
Probably trying to box us in,
Utro said.
Probably,
Aralani agreed.
Oskim?
30 seconds to optimal positioning,
the weapons officer said.
Octrimo, tweak us about 5 degrees starboard.
5 degrees starboard. Acknowledged,
Octrimo said. And once again, the outside view shifted.
Bogies 2 and 3 opening fire,
Bicleon announced.
Don't know why. They're way out of range.
Probably trying to distract us or slow us down,
Octrimo said.
We're starting to pull a little ahead of Bogey 1.
Slow down to match,
Aralani ordered.
We don't want to lose him.
Bogey 1 pitching negative,
Oskim snapped.
It's angling out of line with the breachers.
They must have spotted them,
Utro bit out.
Get a tractor on it. Bring it back up onto Vector. Belay that,
Aralani said, keying the tactical to her chair's repeater display. Oskim and Wutro would be running the numbers, but it was already clear to her that at the patrol cruiser's current distance, it was too massive for the Vigilance tractor beams to have any effect. But a little farther away, and just past the cruiser, was a small meteoroid.
Tractor on this instead,
she said, marking the chunk of rock and sending the target data to the weapons station.
Full power! Try to draw it up into the cruiser's ventral bow area.
Got it,
Oskim said, busying himself with his board. Aralani turned to the tactical. The tractor beam caught the meteoroid, yanking it out of its lazy tumble and sending it arrowing toward the patrol cruiser. If they spotted the sudden new threat, and if they responded as reflexively as Aralani hoped...
Bogey 1 pitching back positive,
Bicleon reported,
dodging the meteoroid, heading back toward the breachers.
Not exactly toward them, Aralani saw, but close enough.
Fire at the breachers,
she ordered. Once again, there was a stuttering of light as the aft lasers blazed, this time targeting not the attacking ship, but the breachers. The missiles disintegrated, sending their payloads bursting out into an expanding cloud of acid. The patrol cruiser had almost instantly recognized its mistake and was again pitching to try to evade the attack. But its momentum was working against it. The acid was spreading outward too rapidly, and before the warship could get clear, the edge of the cloud swept over its portside flank. And as the acid burned into the hull, destroying sensor nodes and missile targeting systems, and digging blackened pits into the metal, the Vigilance lasers once again opened fire, blazing into the ragged surface and digging even deeper through the hull. 15 seconds into the barrage, the Vigilance laser fire burned away enough of the hull to reach the patrol cruiser's remaining missiles, and the warship disintegrated in a violent explosion.
Full acceleration,
Aralani ordered.
And keep scanning. If there's anything else out there, I want to know before it starts shooting at us.
Wutro stepped closer to the command chair as the Vigilant leapt forward toward the wrecked base and the remaining 3 ships.
Nicely done, Admiral,
she said quietly.
I'll just point out what the number squinters on Chila will probably say, that we could have cut and run and saved the Ascendancy a couple of breaches. What? Run away from a patrol cruiser and a couple of patrol ships?
Aralani scoffed.
We'd never have heard the end of it.
Wutro shrugged.
There's that, of course. More important, we'd have lost the chance to see what they're doing over there.
Aralani continued, nodding toward the distant station.
Unless... No,
Wutro said.
I was thinking an in-system jump, but it would have been dangerous with all the wreckage floating around.
So what are they doing?
That's what I want to find out,
Aralani said, studying the tactical. Bogies 2 and 3 were still coming toward the Vigilant, still firing useless laser blasts. But they were moving almost leisurely, as if not wanting to bring things to a head any sooner than they had to. Meanwhile, the repair dock was still floating close beside the wrecked station. Were they getting their people out? Or were they... And suddenly, Orellani understood. They weren't getting anything out. They were putting something in.
Spheres, target the station, she snapped. Saturation volley, and keep going until we're dry.
Yes, ma'am,
Oskim said.
Admiral?
Utro asked quietly as the launchers began spitting plasma spheres toward the distant station.
The station? Not the patrol ships?
Yes, Orellani said. All that laser fire is their way of hiding what the people from the repair dock are doing at the station.
Which is?
I think they're planning to destroy it, Orellani said grimly. Not just wreck it, like the original attack did, but completely disintegrate it.
Interesting,
Utro muttered.
Must be something in there they really don't want us to see. Though I'd have sworn we checked out the place pretty thoroughly our last time through.
Maybe something new has been added, Orellani said. I'm hoping we can hit and scramble whatever self-destruct devices they've put in before they detonate.
Well, if we can't, it won't be through lack of effort,
Utro said, nodding at the stream of plasma spheres still racing away from the Vigilant.
You sure you don't want to keep a few back, in case they decide to make a real fight of it?
They won't, Orellani said. As soon as the sabotage is finished, they'll be out of... And there they go.
She interrupted herself as the two patrol ships veered off in opposite directions, angling away from the Vigilant. Behind them, the repair dock was now turning and driving away from the station.
Orders, Admiral?
Oskim asked from the weapons station. Orellani checked the displays. The Vigilant had covered a lot of distance toward the station in the past few minutes, but they were still too far for a decent shot. But it wouldn't hurt to try.
See what you can do with the repair dock, she said. Lasers only. Keep the spheres saturating the station.
Yes, ma'am.